Hello everybody, and welcome to my talk about single image secure boot with Bareboots. My name is Ahmed Fattoum. I work for Pingotronics. We do embedded Linux development and consulting. And I think a lot of the people here in the room might guess a lot of our new projects, or most of them actually, are employing some scheme of secure boot. This is mostly, I think, motivated by upcoming EU regulation, which should make it more difficult for digital products to be compromised. And in the embedded space that we are working in, in the embedded space we are in, this usually takes the form of a verified boot chain. So I have two short slides about that. So usually you have some hardware root of trust in the form of eFuses, for example. In these eFuses, which you can only burn once, so you only can change a 0 to a 1, but never a 1 to a 0, you can encode the hash of a public key. And using that hash of a public key, you can verify the bootloader. The bootloader itself will have in its verified contents the public key, which it uses to verify the kernel image. If you don't want to use the same key that you are also using to verify the bootloader itself, then the OS image will contain, for example, the hash of a dmVerity root file system, and that will be used to verify all blocks within it. And now you have a chain of trust stretching from applications running in user space to the hardware with the key that was burnt in the factory. Of course, if you can mount an attack on the bootloader, all this securing is for naught, because you can compromise everything from the bootloader onwards. And because of that, you need to invest time to secure the bootloader if you are going to do a secure boot chain. And securing the bootloader is mostly about restricting stuff. So you restrict what it can do, and you restrict what can be done with it. And this has far-reaching consequences. So development is certainly more awkward, because you need to sign your images always. Testing is more complex, because you wouldn't give access to a bootloader shell, for example. And the kind of stuff we test, for example, if you have a watchdog, you want to decrease an attempt, and if you get the watchdog after an update, you want to roll back to another update, to the old system, for example. This is very complicated to test when you don't have a bootloader shell, because you can't directly ask the bootloader and inspect its boot state. And because development and testing is more complex, also maintenance will be more work, and overall complexity of the system is higher. The risk that you don't finish it on time, or that it costs too much, is higher as well. And of course, the manufacturing, the factory setup, and the in-field service, when a technician goes to repair something, they will also need to be authenticated and authorized, so that's also more effort. So if you are going to secure boot a product, you will have to tackle these issues somehow. And the thing is, developers solve issues. So if the solve problems. So if the problems is it is very awkward to develop for the hardware, they will find a way around this awkwardness and, for example, disable secure boot for the development, or use a different build, or, okay, I had CI build this bootloader that's unlocked, and I share it with all my colleagues, for example. And of course, that's not a workable solution, because in the end, it means the state in the field is not adequately tested. And you don't want to debug 2 weeks before you're doing your null series. You want to debug, oh, my integrity setup is taking so long, or now that I have a read-only root FS, some things do not work, because we usually have an overlay FS for development. So project risk is greatly increased if you do not account for how people are going, developers or testers are going to use the product. And I found a nice way to visualize this when we think about device lifecycle. So the same hardware will have different states that it will be in. It can be in development state, it can be in the factory for provisioning, it can be deployed in the field, it can be returned, and each one of them has a different profile or a different threat modeling, what needs to be able to be done. So if you get a field return, of course you want to interact with the hardware, but maybe you should wipe the keys first so you can access patient information, for example. And you need to look at all of this. And the way I see it done in many projects is that you encode the lifecycle state into an image. So you have this image is used for the factory, this image is used in production, this image is used when we have a field return. It might be the same image for factory and field return, for example, but this is a disaster waiting to happen if that image leaks. Here is an example. So Nintendo, for the Wii and the Wii U setup, they had special SD cards with a special factory bootloader. And then after they were done with them, they gave them to their contractor. They were crushed, broken, thrown away. Resourceful people were able to get a hold of them with some, I like the way they phrased it, with a little straightening and convincing, I was able to recover the data. Of course, that's not the bootloader, that's actually deployed everywhere. And it had much less eyes on it, much less usage, and they found exploits in it that allowed them to root the devices. And yeah, so just using the image to handle a lifecycle state is not adequate because any leak would be disastrous. And thus the image should verify that the state is correct. So, for example, you have an e-fuse and you burn that e-fuse in the factory, and after that the image will check the e-fuse, oh, it's burnt, I will not do anything anymore. So the factory image is only valid as long as this e-fuse is not burnt. Or devices that are returning from the field, they have a field return e-fuse, and when that field return e-fuse is burnt, wipe all data, unlock the device, but you can't go back to the normal. So you have fuses that mark how you transition through states. And once you have that, you can go the extra step and have the same boot image handle multiple of these lifecycle states, because it already has to verify that a fuse is burnt. Then you just need to implement the fallback behavior, basically. And one can argue that this increases complexity, but I would rather argue that it just shifts complexity around. If you have a lot of multiple images, the complexity is in the way you do testing and the way you maintain. The complexity is like in the whole workflow and infrastructure around it that you need to juggle these images around. But if you put this complexity in runtime by having by knowing I am in this lifecycle state, I will do that, you move it to a place where it's more easily auditable and you can run tests against it and so on. And yes, that's enough for the theory, and I have some more practical example. But yeah, in summary, what I want to say is the fewer the images, the better, I think, and a single image is achievable, and I think it brings real benefits. So an example for fuse-based state transitions in Opti. So Opti, which is a trusted execution environment maintained by Linaro, it's like what you would normally use on many embedded systems. And often it's provisioned with device-specific certificates in the factory. So you want the device to call back into the mother cloud, and then it has a device-specific certificates. And these certificates are stored into replay-protected memory. And you can only do the storage after you have written a key into the eMMC, which the eMMC will save in some secrets place, and then the SOC can, I think authenticate is the correct word, authenticate towards the eMMC with an HMAC that stuff is authorized to be stored there. So, yeah. And the thing is, because you can only, because you need this SOC specific key, it can only happen after secure boot is enabled. So in your factory step, you must, after having enabled secure boot, verified boot, write this RPMB key. And now if you had an image that writes this RPMB key and it leaks, then people could modify the RPMB contents, yeah, if they reuse that image. Opti has an option, config RPMB write key, And if you enable it, it will ask the eMMC, do you have a key built in or key programmed? If it's not programmed, it will transfer a new key. And you can't have Opti every time asking the eMMC, are you programmed? Because an attacker could just desolder the eMMC, add a fresh eMMC, the fresh eMMC will answer, yeah, of course, I am not programmed. And then you can just snoop the clear text sending of the key on the bus. And yeah. And to curtail that, my colleague Marco Felsch made some pull requests for Opti. And the idea is that instead of having one image where we always enable RPMB write key and one image where we always disable it, we always enable RPMB write key, but before the key write, we always check if a specific eFuse burnt or not. And after the key write, we blow the eFuse. And this way we have in our lifecycle graph a link that only goes into one direction, so it was in unprovisioned eMMC state, now it's in provisioned eMMC state, and you can just do a replay and get the key this way. For that he added for one OTP, one-time pad support for IMX processors to Opti, there is an open pull request for that, and there was a second pull request to do this fuse checking and writing in Opti. There was a very fruitful upstream discussion about how to do this better, so there will be a second pull request coming and some form of replay protection in addition, but it will still be gated behind an eFuse, and I think we can use this model of gating stuff behind the eFuse at many more places, and with that we eliminate the image, the different image that we usually would have. Another thing I wanted to show is access control and access control in the bootloader. So that's not something that's usually done. And the status quo is that runtime access control in the bootloader is a mess because everyone using the bootloader in a different way and everyone defines their own threat model and what might be secure for one is not secure for someone else. And if you are writing your own board code, whether it be in U-Boot or Barebox, it will be very complicated stuff where you push into the guts of the bootloader to selectively enable or disable features. And that's the way you would handle different security states. So for example, here's an example from Barebox. It doesn't look very nice. So it checks a lockdown variable that you've, for example, got from the one-time pad. And if it's set, you can call bootemp force signed images. This is a function that enforces that fit images must be signed, and you can't get back from that. And alternatively, if that's not the case, it will get the console and enable it and switch it to the open PinMux state. And yeah, this is a lot of specialized code. No one can keep all of that off mind, and it's easy to get something wrong with that. And no one is upstreaming this code. So so while this is more infrastructure, it's bot specific and no one bothers to upstream it, which makes every project reinvent the wheel. For Barebox, I introduced last year Barebox security policies. And the idea is that you have these is allowed macros that can check specific security decisions and at the privileged operation itself. So inside the get char function, which you would use to get a character, there is a check, is allowed console input. And if it's not allowed, it will return an error. And this way, you can have very future-proof access control because you are disabling the feature directly where it is. For example, another example is the environment. You don't want to load a mutable environment, arbitrary mutable environment in your infield case. And instead of, but you want to have the environment for the development case. So instead of trying to disable all ways you might load the environment, you go directly into the environment code and you add an is allowed that prevents loading the environment. And then you know for sure if there is some new way to load the environment added, it will be still covered because you are directly at the privileged operation where you do this check. I have some slides how the security policies look like. So these are kconfig files in the end, but they are not used for compile time, but for runtime decisions. If you do security old config, you are asked interactively. If you do security menu config, you get a menu config. And there it asks you a question, should console input be opened? Should shell script be executed? Should fastboot OEM commands be supported, and so on. And you can have multiple of these security policies. So you can have one for lockdown, one for development, one for a factory, one for field return, as you want. You just define, these are the security policies I have. You call this function, and it will ask you one by one these security relevant options. And it's only the security relevant ones. So it's not like kconfig, where you must really have the insight into the bootloader to decide, okay, is this something I want to enable, disable? So if you read, for example, fastboot OEM commands, you might not know that this allows you to run arbitrarily commands. So this is usually something you don't want. But in this security config view, it only asks you actually actionable questions. Then in the end, you get a number of kconfig style files with this sconfig for security config in front. And these are normalized by kconfig. And these are all compiled into the bootloader. And then you can have in your build time kconfig, you can set a default policy, for example, lockdown. So the device, as soon as it starts, it will be in the lockdown policy, is what will be active. And then bot code can decide to move into a different state depending on a fuse, for example. That's here. It can choose an active policy, and then the bootloader can do stuff with that. And the nice thing is you can have this clean separation. So you have the policy side that you are defining on a per bot basis with this kconfig-like mechanism. And then you have the mechanism side, which actually applies the security policy. And that's in common code that different projects can collaborate on that, and not everyone needs to figure out how do I reliably disable the environment, or how do I reliably ensure that only whitelisted variables are passed through, for example. And then you can and these decisions are enforced. So here is an example for this policy selection. So it uses the NVMEM API to read fuse. This factory and VMEM cell, and if it fails to read that fuse, it does security policy select lockdown. I only added this for descriptive purposes. It should be already in lockdown mode. And if, for example, a factory done fuse is not burned, it would select the devil mode. And then in the devil mode, you could say, I have console input enabled, I have USB OEM, fastboot OEM enabled, and so on. And in the factory, you would always burn this factory done fuse at the end, and then developers would get the device without that factory done fuse burned. Last thing I wanted to talk about is runtime unlocking. So going back to what I said at first, you want to give developers an easy escape hatch, but you don't want to make it too easy, otherwise they do not test the normal boot flow. And this is something we had used for in a few projects now, and I like it pretty much, which is we have two fuses. One fuse is the factory done fuse, and one is, okay, we haven't decided on a good name yet. One is partially done, one is very, very done. And you would burn both fuses for all devices that go into the field. But for developers, you would only burn one fuse of them. And when you have only this one fuse burned, it would say factory fuse intact. And then it will just poll for 5 seconds that you press the key D. It will tell you, press D to enter devil mode. And then when you press D, it will enter devil mode. And then you have a bootloader shell. And the testing system can interact with the bootloader and do stuff. And if you don't press it, it will just continue a normal secure boot with no console, for example, or only read-only console, and it will only check EMMC, it will not allow network boot, and so on, and so on. And the nice thing is about that is if you just let the device start up, the default behavior is that it will start up like it does in the field, just with a delay of 5 seconds. instead of having devices that are permanently open and permanently locked and not testing the permanently locked state as often. Yeah, for unlocking, that's for a development device. If you have production devices that are fully fused, you can have also unlock tokens. So I have seen this implemented in board code, in U-boot, and in Barebox before, but there is no generic way to do it. For Barebox, a few years ago, I added JSON web token support. You can pass JSON in the bootloader now, but it's verified first, and then it's passed. And yeah, that was possible with RSA signatures. My colleague Jonas will, in an hour or so, talk about the TLV format, which is another way to store the tokens also on the device. And ECDSA signatures are also now supported. And an important point about these unlock tokens is that they must be bound to a device. In Barebox, there is now an API for that that gives you a unique ID that's implemented for multiple socks. And this is very important because you don't want an unlock token leaking or reproduced to unlock other devices. So the way it works is you have a public key, for example, ECDSA public key in the bootloader, statically compiled in, and then it's used to verify the token, and the token has a claim that says, I am only valid on this one device. And if it's not, then it's not unlocked. And this is another way that you can allow developers to unlock hardware while the system is completely secure booting. But once they remove a USB stick or once they wipe the data, it reverts to the original state. The same data can also be in an Android verified boot TA, for example. Yeah, and that brings me to my last slide. So for the future, there is work on generic system data TA. So if you don't have a full-blown TPM, but you have Opti, there are still some things that would be really nice to have just with a Opti TA for exactly this purpose, which is having a key value store and having rollback protection and write once variables. And you could store signed blobs there, and then you can verify, for example, that this device is allowed to be in developer mode, and then you can send, again, it should be in normal in-field mode, and because it's stored in the replay protected memory area, you can't revert to the old state. So this work is underway for that, and yeah, we are looking forward to publish this at Pingotronics. Yeah, I'm not sure if we will try to get this into Opti upstream, but yes, we'll publish that and provide user space tools and also bootloader integration, and I hope it would be a useful building blocks for these kind of things. Yeah, I had a talk in August which went more into detail about Barebox for secure booting system. We have fixed a number of memory leaks now, especially the hash shell was a very difficult nut to crack, but it doesn't leak anymore, so hopefully we can actually run the fuzz tests in CI with OSS fuzz in the future. I'm looking forward to that. And the big problem that we haven't completely tackled yet is we want to pass along the security policy we have to Linux, for example, the kernel command line. So if you select the devil or the lockdown security policy in the bootloader, that should also affect the way you start, for example, an SSH daemon in the user space. And we would need some way to communicate this information in a secure manner, for example, over the kernel command line. We are not sure yet about how to do that, but that's on the agenda. Yeah, and that's it. So that's a QR code for the Barebox security documentation if you want to read more. These are a few links. And yeah, I am ready for questions. Thank you.
We have time for one question.
Hey, thanks for the talk. I just one question. The thing is, you seem to lock really completely the device once it's in production. The problem is most really corner cases will happen at customer, and you will have to probably debug that. In this case, is there a way, did you find a way to address this issue? To be able to take a device that's in production and you need to somehow find a way to authenticate with the device to be able to debug it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's what I meant here with runtime unlock. It's this one, but this one, you can have signed tokens per device. And yeah, you would keep the private key somewhere safe. And when you have a field return, you would get it out, sign a token with it, and then you can use it to unlock the device. But you need to have beforehand included the key to do it, for doing that.
Yeah. Because I remember you said that you would fuse two bits to be able to say now it's in production. Could it be worth to have a bit that says now this device was in production, now we put it back in testing, so yeah, we lock some critical features?
So the thing is, bot code has complete control about over when to select the different policies. It's just a function call away. All so right. You can check a fuse, but you can also check a token. So you can mix both, and that's what you would do. Some processors also have built-in field return capability, like the IMX processors. Mm-hmm. So you can generate a special case field return bootloader, only valid for a single SOC. Use that to unlock the system. It will wipe the hardware unique key or make it inaccessible. So it wipes all data that's all data that's encrypted with it, and then you can do the debugging.
All right, thank you.
So if you have hardware-specific measures, you said. If you don't, you can re-implement it with JSON Web Tokens, for example, in Barebox.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.